From Community Public Radio, this is CPR Sunday. In New York, I'm Don DeBar. And this week, we have journalist and activist Tony Solo reporting on news and events in Latin America and the Caribbean from Managua, Nicaragua. Tony, welcome back.
Hi, Don. It's good to be back after a long break.
Yeah.
And I know there you've had the Democrat and Republican conventions. I suppose that's taken up a lot of your time. And down here, things are just the usual craziness.
Yeah. Yeah, the Democratic and Republican conventions. Apparently, a number of my Facebook friends thanked me for going and checking it out so they didn't have to watch it on TV.
Right. Well, I can understand that.
Yeah.
A lot of people will sympathize with that.
Yeah. So, so what's been happening? It's been a couple of weeks, so there's a lot going on.
So, yeah, and I suppose what's been happening over the last two or three weeks, and we can... The developments over the last week will kind of more or less enable us to get back up to speed, because I know that what's happened over the last week is basically a continuation of what's been going on for the last couple of months.
Right, that's true.
And there are various things going on. There's Venezuela is trying to carry out its duties as the temporary president of Mercosur in the face of bitter opposition from the right-wing governments currently in power in Paraguay, Argentina, and Brazil. Mm-hmm. So that is part of the international right-wing's effort to isolate the Venezuelan government and make it more difficult for the Venezuelan government to reach an agreement with the internal opposition. It's the internal opposition have been resolutely resisting the attempts at dialogue, and that dialogue, as far as I know, and I haven't seen any reports that there's been an explicit public meeting. There may be. I'm sure that there are behind the scenes contacts, but the dialogue process that the Organization of American States have approved, that the Union of South American Nations has approved, and they've set up mechanisms for it, and the Venezuelan government itself has been calling for dialogue. Mm-hmm. But the Venezuelan opposition don't want a dialogue, and so what's happening on the international scene, certainly in terms of Mercosur, is very clearly a part of an international effort by right-wing governments to not just maintain and feed into the massive international media and national media campaign within Venezuela against Nicolas Maduro's government. And it's also an attempt to influence internal events by making the Venezuelan opposition's stance, that refusing to talk with the government, look more reasonable.
Right. I mean, what they're doing, basically, the National Assembly, the right-wing majority in the National Assembly, is acting as a fifth column to this international effort, which comes within the context, the enabling legal context of Obama's executive order that declares that Venezuela is a threat to U.S. national security, and thus, therefore, you know, you're allowed to do just about anything, like organize efforts like this. It's legally authorized. Whether that's what's happening or not hasn't been demonstrated definitively yet, but it seems that's what's happening.
Yeah, and also very clearly, it's an attempt by the international right wing, led by the United States, and backed up by these right wing governments in Paraguay, Brazil, and Argentina, to try and they're really fed up that they haven't been able to impose a recall referendum this year. And what's happening with that process inside Venezuela, and the Venezuelan opposition, for some reason, deliberately didn't initiate the process that they have to go through under Venezuela's 1998 constitution. Until it was too late. It was actually too late when they initiated that process for them to get a recall referendum this year. And my take on that is that they did it deliberately, so as to provoke a situation in which their outside allies could then claim that this is another sign of the lack of democracy in Venezuela. Right. But in fact, they themselves started the process too late to be able to get a recall referendum in, under the kind of periods that are specified for that process, which is, you know, and it's so ironic, the mere fact that Venezuela has a recall referendum process for the presidency makes it inherently one of the most democratic countries on the planet, if not the most.
Right.
But you get all these right-wing governments saying, you know, the place is a dictatorship. And it's just so, it's just anybody with half a brain could see that massive contradiction. But in fact, the way it's pitched in the international media, it's pitched in such a way with zero context, that ordinary consumers of news will just imbibe the dictatorship lie and assume that in Venezuela there's some kind of attempt by the authorities to deny the recall vote, when in fact the recall vote has been given approval,
right,
but for next year under the terms of the electoral law, it's Venezuela's electoral authority, I think it's the Council for the National Electoral Council, something like that it's called, and they are a separate power of the state, separate from the executive, separate from the legislature, separate from the judiciary, and separate from what's called the citizens' power. And they have authorized the MUD coalition to go ahead with the referendum process, but which involves now at this stage, the next stage is that the MUD political grouping has to accumulate 4 million valid signatures to, and then once those signatures are validated and approved, then there'll be a date fixed for the recall referendum. And that's how the process is going to work, and it's going to work out in 2017. But under Venezuela's constitution, a recall referendum held that close to the next elections does not mean that the current president has to leave power, or it doesn't mean that the current president has to leave power and then there are elections. It means that power passes to the vice president.
Right, until the elections, he's the custodian until the regularly scheduled elections.
Yeah,
you know, the calendar
2018.
Here, the calendar here again has U.S. context, because it seems to me that if the U.S. were to intervene directly or obviously in Venezuela, that they would prefer that happen with Obama, so that there's no political cost since he's going out, rather than Clinton, or leaving it in Trump's lap, who may decide not to intervene if what he's saying about foreign policy is true. He did say no regime change.
Right. And all that, and that's encouraging. That would make anybody vote for Trump, wouldn't it?
Yeah.
Without, you know, who's concerned about international developments and their effects on the prospects for international peace. But anyway, I know.
Let me just tell you something on that, by the way, because I witnessed this and my pants almost fell off, okay, from the weight. When Trump said affirmatively at his acceptance speech in Cleveland, no more regime change and, you know, essentially no more meddling, no more nation building, all that, the assembled Republican delegates stood up and they enthusiastically applauded that. I mean, like, with vigor. I was watching that and saying to myself, wow, that is definitely... If that's got to be the center of gravity among the populace in terms of the actual issues. And it's had no expression until Trump in the political process. Even Sanders didn't say that stuff.
Right. Well, that's a very important development. And let's see how if it turns out to have sufficient influence in the election to make a difference. And going back to all this controversy in Venezuela and around the international response to Venezuela. And shifting the focus to Argentina, and what you see, one of the things that I find absolutely fascinating and almost wholly repellent about the international media, mainstream media coverage, is that, for example, in Mexico, for example, there was a report the other day that halfway through the current presidency of President Peña Nieto, the number of disappearances in Mexico is already, I think it's twice that of the number of disappearances that under Felipe Calderón, the previous president, in the whole of Felipe Calderón's presidency. Now, the mere fact that there are any disappearances in Mexico, in contemporary Latin America, never mind the fact that under Peña Nieto, they're double, even halfway through his presidency, what they were under the previous president. And that should set off a fierce campaign in the mainstream media against the abuses that are happening in Mexico. But it's you hear virtually nothing about that.
Instead, you hear that Maduro won't hold the only provided for presidential recall in the hemisphere, and that shows that that's an undemocratic country, and they're silent about what's happening in Mexico.
Yeah, and the contrast is so stark, isn't it? But and I hope we'll have time to talk a little bit more about that. But and again, confirming that, you have this situation in Argentina where, do you remember in our last programs, the last couple of conversations, we've been talking about, well, in Argentina, we know that the right-wing government policy program is going to generate fierce opposition, and that's likely to lead to a situation where the right wing will be unelectable by the time the next election comes around in two and a half, three years, whatever it is. Mm-hmm. And so then the question is, well, how will the right wing deal with that in Argentina? Mm-hmm. And the fear is that they'll, because they know that their policies are so hugely unpopular and are generating such opposition, they'll shift into policies of quite severe repression and all kinds of abuses of power in order to sustain themselves in government and somehow achieve a satisfactory electoral outcome in the next elections. And so the latest sign of that is that there are various signs of it, but the way the judiciary is being abused in Argentina to bring really frivolous cases against, for example, Cristina Fernandez de Kirchner, the previous president, and really frivolous cases, and that have almost no basis in certainly in fact, and sometimes even in law.
Right.
In the case of the former president Cristina, but also they're bringing all these cases against other members of her administration, and one case in particular, the so-called Dollar Futures case, the people who should actually be in the dock are the president himself, Mauricio Macri, right, and his cronies, right, who engaged in speculation around a measure that was designed to protect the value of the Argentine peso.
Right.
But what they've done is they've found judges and public prosecutors who will engage in a process to accuse the former President Cristina and her colleagues of the very crimes, if you like, that they themselves committed. And another aspect of it is that they're actually, do you remember the Madres de Plaza de Mayo, the mothers of the May Square? Well, they've decided to reactivate their weekly protests. And the leader of the Madres de la Plaza de Mayo is an incredible woman called Hebe de Bonafini. And even she now has become the target of judicial attacks. And she was she was on the brink of being arrested, kind of, you know, this, imagine this 83-year-old or whatever age she is, she's in her 80s, being handcuffed and carted off to jail in front of the television camera.
On TV, yeah.
And that no, and so they stepped back from that because they realized that the publicity would be so hugely negative. But they're still going after her in judicial terms.
It sounds like Brazil, so, by the way. This is the same thing that they did with Dilma Rousseff, that they're doing with Dilma Rousseff. The very well, accusers were the ones that committed the crime.
Oh, yeah, and in relation to Brazil, just this last week, the president of one of Brazil's biggest companies called Odebrecht, a huge global engineering company, came out and accused the current coup regime leader, is it Temer?
Yeah, Michel Temer.
Of being on the take from him.
Right, that's right. I paid him off.
Yeah, and absolutely astonishing. And I don't want to get sidetracked by that because
go ahead.
So I'm looking at that, but all that stuff in the same way that the absolutely catastrophic situation in Mexico in terms of human rights and so forth is not reported in the mainstream media. Similarly, events in Argentina don't get reported. And so, you know, if you were to ask anybody who takes even a mild interest in Latin America, you know, what do you think about the Hebe Bonafini case? They'll probably say, what?
Right.
You know, they probably don't know about it because it's simply not reported.
Yeah, you go to the New York Times, go to the New York Times website, click on World, and then click on the Americas. Nothing.
Right. Right. So, you know, what does all that mean? It seems to me that what that means is that there's it is rational to talk about a global media conspiracy in terms of the Western media.
Yep.
But what is that about? And if you start, and just to wrap up the first point I want to make, it's very, very clear that the right-wing governments in Argentina, Mexico, and Brazil are very aware that they face serious difficulties in terms of maintaining the electoral democratic facade that they're so keen to project to defend their legitimacy. But in fact, in Argentina, what you're seeing is a slowly ratcheting up increase in terms of repression, because they know, the right wing know, that they can't, they're not going to get good electoral outcomes from what they're currently doing.
Right.
And their response to that is what I feared in our previous conversations, that they're just going to shift more and more towards increasingly repressive policies.
Yep.
And I think we'll see that, I'm sad to say, over the next, even the next 6 months, we're likely to see that, including in Brazil.
Well, we saw Macri start that, you know, at the kickoff when he took office, even before the Congress had met. He started trying to take down the independent media, which, you know, sets the stage for everything else
come. Yeah. So then, Telesur and all that.
Yep.
There's that aspect. But then when you look at it again, when you kind of try and take a step back and look at it in continental terms and even global terms, you know, what does it mean when, for example, in Nicaragua's case, there was a report in the liberal media site Truth out recently, where I think it was a report by a woman called Courtney Parker, who's supposed to be an academic and an anthropologist or something. And she actually published a report that reproduced a downright lie about events in northern Nicaragua to do with the Mosquito people. And she reported an attack allegedly on people from a Mosquito people's political group, but in fact that wasn't true. What happened was that activists and militants from that indigenous people's political group actually attacked some government supporters, But that got completely turned on its head in the Truth Out report. So, and why is this happening? Why is this? What is all this media stuff? What's it about? Mm. And what it's about, it seems to me, I think this is a very important discussion to have, is that the falling rate of profit that is affecting global corporations, especially in this current very depressed global economic context, means that the only way that they can kind of rescue their profits and kind of increase the productivity that they need to increase in order to increase their profits is to attack ordinary people's living standards and ordinary people's incomes. And wherever possible, to shift the responsibility for maintaining the majority of the working force in some shape or form onto the government in the form of social security payments, health support, and that kind of thing. Right. And I think that is what that, when, why are there these right wing? In the short term in Brazil, for example, you can say, oh, well, no, that's not the case. It was the elite just defending themselves against the corruption investigations that were actually set in train by Dilma Rousseff, and they then kind of hijacked through under the corruption investigation bus as if she were the person that was corrupt. I'm going back to what we were talking about in Argentina. But I disagree with that. And I think that maybe that was the immediate cause, but the broader cause of the prevalence of these right-wing usurpations, and I insist on using that term, it's not a conservative restoration.
Right, I agree with you.
It's an usurpation of power by the regional right-wing.
Or a seizure,
because restoration implies seizure. Some kind of natural process, but it's right. not a natural process.
Right.
So why is that happening? And it's happening, in my opinion, it's happening because the international corporate elites in the Western Hemisphere and are looking at Latin America, and they're seeing that the progressive governments actually are offering a better political model, and not even a better political model, but a better political and economic model.
Right.
And they're offering a better package that's way out of reach of any right-wing formula. Yep. It's far beyond, they achieve good results despite the global recession. I mean, look at Nicaragua.
And despite global war, despite the economic warfare as well.
Oh, yeah, absolutely. And that's not the case currently in Venezuela. But my interpretation of that is that just goes to show that that Venezuela is the most important target in the region for the right wing to destroy.
Yep.
Right?
Yeah, indeed. You know, there's something else, too. Macri moved against the media when he came into power there, and you see this, collapsing of options in any event for the economic elite. You also see an actual uprising at the belly of the beast in the United States, which definitely has had the elite's attention, represented by the people who supported Sanders, represented by the people supporting Trump, and represented by the people in the streets, Black Lives Movement, etc. They're scared to death. And the way they manage all of that is turn around and point to Trump, who's advocating a different foreign policy, as being a Russian stooge. It's the same game that they played in 1948, 1952, et cetera, only it's the Democrats that are doing it. Well, it was Truman that did it, too. That's why he was placed there in the first place. And but what that does is it enables it enables this anti-worker, anti-socialism mentality that's going to be used when it's time to intervene in Venezuela and other places here.
Right. And I had a brief email exchange with somebody I hadn't heard from for years and years and years. And they wrote to me recently, and they sent me a link to an article by the anti-Sandinista writer Tim Rogers, who for many years, over 10 years, worked either on Tico Times or on something which is a Costa Rican English language newspaper. or media outlet, and also on something that he set up called Nicaragua Dispatch. And he's a kind of right down the line anti-Sandinista ideologue. Right. And he's now working for something called Fusion.net, which is a kind of funky style newsy website. And this old friend I hadn't heard from for years sent me a link to an article by Tim Rogers in which he doesn't identify himself as being, you know, a long-standing journalist. He, you know, certainly doesn't. He makes very clear his anti-Sandinista position, but not. He doesn't refer to his record as, you know, somebody who's written for 10 years attacking the Sandinistas. And so anybody reading that article would simply take it as, you know, this guy from the States lives in Nicaragua, so we'd better take seriously what he's got to say about Nicaragua, which is absolute, you know, it's absolute nonsense.
Right.
So then I wrote back to my friend, so I sometimes think that people in the US live on another planet, because this is just so. And he was, Rogers was coming out with these usual, you know, Daniel Ortega's a dictator. The Nicaragua's been taken over by the Ortega family, and it's all, you know, it's just the usual ideologically based attacks on the Sandinista government here in Nicaragua. And I think my friend was actually offended that I suggested that people in the United States were out of touch with reality, because I didn't hear from her. You know?
Yeah, it's true. It's so true, though. They are. They are out of touch.
You know, I know, and even ordinary people in the States will say, well, people in the United States aren't interested in foreign affairs.
Not true.
And that's
not true.
But it's so, I don't know, it's just so difficult for people outside the United States to try and kind of establish an effective kind of communication or discussion about what's happening in the world, because people in the United States rely on media like, you know, that. Where do they get their news from? I mean, they either get their news from the prestigious news outlets like the New York Times, and the undeservedly prestigious news outlets like the New York Times, the Washington Post, the Los Angeles Times, or McClatchy News, or all these news information outlets. And they increasingly, they're getting them from these kind of style-based sites and identity-based sites, right, like Fusion. But if you then look at, if you follow up, who's behind Fusion.net? You know, so you go online and you kind of look about us and who we are, and you kind of drill down, and what you ultimately find is that Fusion.net is owned by something called Broadcasting Media Corporation, something like that, which is a group of investors that have Thomas Dearborn, Saman, these big investor outfits, many of them with, in the same Saman's case, closely linked to Israel. And so what do writers like Tim Rogers, you know, what are they? They're just ciphers for this corporate elite who don't hire people who are not going to write what they want.
Right. That's right. So they
do. And the immediate group behind Fusion is Univision, the big, I think they're based in Mexico, aren't they?
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
But they've been taken over by this group of elite corporate investors who very clearly share the same agenda as the right-wing elites in Brazil and Argentina and Mexico. Right?
And the United States, if you look at the money in the presidential campaign and in Congress, Wall Street's money goes to Clinton, Ryan, you know, the establishment of both parties.
Right. So I know there's nothing new there, is that? We're not saying anything new. And it's interesting to see the detail, and I just find it interesting to be able to, we have the luxury of here in Nicaragua of being able to step back and take a kind of, you know, a measured view, because we're not right up against it on the front line fighting the enemy, the repressive enemy that wants to destroy the lives of ordinary people. Mm. You know, and here in Nicaragua, I know is that we're so lucky, and touch wood, because we have a government that is actually working on behalf of ordinary people. The other thing that's interesting about the government here is the way that they're playing the very contradictions that the international economic situation have generated. So they, because they're so successful in the economic terms, well, certainly, I mean, it's all relative, isn't it? I mean, that here in Nicaragua, I think Nicaragua and Bolivia are a couple of the countries. I think the other one's Chile, that are scheduled or projected by the Economic Commission for Latin America and the Caribbean to have quite good growth around 5%, right, for the next year or so. And they're the only, you know, and President Obama would die to have growth of around 5%, mm-hmm, you know, and so, but and because Nicaragua has been able to be relatively successful in those terms, it's able to attract investment, and so it's just so paradoxical that the government, the Sandinista government, has been so successful and is able to receive investment initiatives from people who you normally expect to be its diehard enemies.
Yep.
You know, Walmart, yep, you know, and what's the other one that's Walmart, PriceMart, I've forgotten the other one, Cargill. You know, and they're, in terms, you know, looked at it in moral terms, who wants their money? Right. But looked at it in economic terms,
right,
and how is Nicaragua going to generate employment? You know, I mean, you know that argument.
And deliver goods, too. I mean, so then, you know, Walmart.
And that's,
Walmart,
you know,
actually,
it's just so interesting that Nicaragua is able to exploit the paradoxes and the contradictions that are thrown up by the global international economic situation.
Yeah, and you know, it makes it a target, of course, because it's a successful model of the alternative. And, you know, I think the economic is part of the moral. You know, taking care of the people's needs by whatever mechanism is part of the moral environment.
Yeah, and in the current global economy, and what options does a small country of around 6 million people have?
Right.
You know, and what are its options? Yeah. A revolution all on its own?
Well, it's had a revolution, but and so when somebody's sitting down negotiating with Walmart, they represent the people.
Yeah, and around the time of the July the 19th celebration of the, I think it was the 37th anniversary this year, of the Sandinista revolution, and that revolution was drowned in blood,
yep,
right, as my colleague Jorge Capelan put it.
Yeah.
And so when leftists kind of throw out their glib, you know, proposals, policy proposals about, oh, what all Daniel Ortega's doing wrong, and it's so easy for them because they didn't lose relatives, you know, all through that period.
Maybe I'm coining a phrase here, but armchair Leninists.
Well, I'm not offering an apology for, and because there are things I don't agree with in terms of Nicaragua's policy mix.
Sure.
But they know what they're doing, and they have much better information, certainly than I do, about the trends that are going to be, you know, that they're going to have to confront over the next year, 2 years. And so, for example, and that's an important experience also that I'm sure Daniel Ortega and Fidel Castro and Raul Castro and their colleagues have communicated to Nicolas Maduro and to Evo Morales. And I think it's something. I'm not a huge fan of Rafael Correa, but and I think that something that Rafael Correa took on board right from the start was precisely that revolutionary experience.
Mm-hmm.
And the experience of the reaction, the very repressive, bloody, aggressive reaction from the continental elites led by the United States and expressed via their tool, which is the United States government.
Mm-hmm. Yep. Yeah, it's a difficult environment when you know, you're trying to set up shop and there's gunfire all around you, and that's right. A metaphor for the condition that these countries face.
Yeah, and sticking with Nicaragua, and there was a very interesting report by a guy called Adolfo Pastrán. Now, Adolfo Pastrán, and he's a very highly respected journalist here in Nicaragua, but he's one of these guys that talks about objective journalism. I'm a good journalist because I'm an objective journalist, you know.
Yeah.
And so I'm not just, and I don't know, it's impossible to take that seriously, right?
Right. Yep.
But and the one of the he's very strongly identified with the business class here, and so when anything that he writes can quite legitimately be interpreted as an expression of the general feeling in the business class here in Nicaragua.
Mm-hmm.
And his most recent report was a report on what the political opposition in Nicaragua has adopted as its strategy coming up to the November the 6th elections. And I remember that in the last poll by the kind of politically centrist polling company M&R Consultants, I was really very surprised, even I was surprised to see that the Nicaraguan opposition doesn't even get up to 6% now of explicit committed voter support. And the Frente Sandinista is kind of up around, I think it's up around 58 or 59 as a party.
Mm.
But Daniel Ortega has 80.2% approval. And Rosario Murillo has 82.7 or something percent approval.
Mm.
No, and it says these figures are absolutely extraordinary. No? And I only mention that to give some context to what Adolfo Pastrán reported. And what Adolfo reported was that he's been in touch with the political opposition, and their strategy is to, Pastrán actually almost puts this in as many words, because they have zero national support, what they're doing is leveraging, I hate that word, but they're leveraging as hard as they can their access to international media so as to discredit the Nicaraguan government. That is the electoral strategy of Nicaragua's political opposition.
Which sounds like setting the stage for a coup, basically.
Well, yeah, and so that there's that. But then the interesting thing from because I'm so kind of immersed in Nicaraguan stuff, is, well, why is Adolfo Pastrán writing that? You know, and why is somebody who represents the business elites in Nicaragua, you know, insofar as Nicaragua has a business elite,
right,
being such a small country, why is somebody who represents and writes and is, you know, he is the kind of journalistic expression of those interests, why is he writing this in a way that's very critical of Nicaragua's political opposition?
Well, if you take a look at the support
can I answer my own question?
Yeah, yeah, sure.
He's doing it because the interests that he represents are extremely concerned that the political opposition is actually going to damage their interests, right?
Yeah, that's what I'm thinking. That also, looking at the numbers of support for Ortega, and Mrs. Ortega, right? You didn't say that, but that's who you're talking about too, right?
Right.
It means a considerable part of the petty bourgeoisie, the middle class, and even some of the bourgeoisie support. And they've been doing well under the Sandinista, you know, with the Sandinista government. They've
right.
You know, basically when you put money in the pockets of the customers, the people that sell and make things make money.
Yeah, and we've had this discussion over and over again, haven't we, Don? And it bears repeating, endlessly repeating, the main objective of the Sandinista government, and it's a revolutionary objective, is to not just reduce poverty, but make it possible for all the people that have been excluded over so long from being able to participate in the economy, from being able to participate in society, from being able to participate politically. And that is their objective, to kind of bring the all Nicaraguans to a point where they're full participants in every aspect of Nicaragua's national life. You know, imagine such a program in the United States.
Oh, they wouldn't,
you know, why does Black Lives Matter exist? Because they're a huge section of US society that's just excluded from participating in every aspect of national life.
Right.
And so what the FSLN government here is doing is they're engaging in this kind of it is a revolutionary process, but it's taking time. I mean, because they've learned that they can't just, if they try and implement those kinds of policies in the short term, they'll just become the victim of a vicious military aggression from the biggest power on the planet.
So
that is the rationale that they're engaged in, of national reconciliation and building alliances and dialogue, and almost everything that one of the reasons Daniel Ortega is and Rosario Murillo are so successful. And also, it's worth pointing out that Rosario Murillo is going to be his vice presidential candidate in these upcoming elections in November.
That's cool.
Which is a hugely popular decision here.
Yeah, I'm sure.
And so almost nothing that Daniel Ortega does is not based on consensus, and that's why he's so popular.
Right. Yep. Even among the elites.
Well, among young people in particular, and they feel they look at their future here in Nicaragua, and they see, you know, there's much better prospects of getting a job. They know they can participate in the economy in some shape or form. They've got a huge range of educational opportunities, perhaps not as well resourced as they should be, but the educational opportunities to learn and to get skills and develop a career and all that stuff, that's laid out before them, and they know that. So that's why Daniel Ortega is so hugely popular among young people, I mean, paradoxically, because what is he now, 70? And so, so you've got this massive integration of youth and the enthusiasm of youth for this Sandinista political project, and also huge support from women, because the last 10 years in Nicaragua have seen women's economic opportunities, and really, It's such an overused word. I mean, there's been a revolution in the way that women are able to participate in the economy, get access to credit, get access to training, and get access to political power. You know, and one of the things that Daniel Ortega made very explicit in the announcement that he wanted to nominate his wife Rosario Murillo to be his vice presidential candidate, was that represented in the most prominent political way the 50-50 balance of political representation that has now been stipulated in Nicaragua's electoral law. By law, every party that registers in Nicaragua to participate in elections has to present a slate of candidates, 50% of whom have to be women by law. Mm-hmm. What would that do in the United States?
Yep, it would change a lot, at least in form.
It would certainly change the kind of the faces in the Senate and the House of Representatives.
Yeah. Instead of having a bunch of old white men, you'd have a bunch of old white men and women.
Well,
that's all right.
So there, and I'm running out of things to talk about.
Well, let's go back to Brazil. Let's go back to Brazil because I wanted to work that a little more.
Oh, there's also Honduras, isn't there?
Oh, yeah, let's go there first, yeah.
So, yeah, and going back to this theme of the contrast between the coverage of countries, and whereby countries like Mexico and countries like Argentina receive hardly the very serious abuse of human rights and political rights in those countries gets practically minimal coverage, if any coverage at all, in mainstream media. And you see that reflected too in our Central American region, whereby the media coverage of the assassination of Berta Cáceres and has kind of, in a paradoxical way, it's kind of distracted attention from the very fundamental democratic problems or problems in Honduras' political democracy. Whereas by contrast, even the most trivial events here in Nicaragua get highlighted and distorted and misrepresented so as to project Nicaragua as a dictatorship. But if you contrast what's going on in Honduras, for example, over the last 2 or 3 weeks while we've been out of contact, there was an occupation by students of the National Autonomous University in Honduras, which is the big public university in Honduras. And during that occupation, there was very serious repression from the police and even the military. And I think it was a first in Honduran history that the military were actually called in onto the university campus in an attempt to intimidate the students that were occupying the university. And as a result of that conflict, something like 75 students, well over 70 students, I think, were indicted and arrested. And they were going to be charged under, I think the charges were basically public order charges, but they carried quite heavy jail terms. Mm-hmm. And so there was every chance that these students were going to be, and 70 students, right? And they're in a tiny country like Honduras.
That's a cell block. Basically. Yeah.
Right. And so and what happened was that there was then a process of negotiation, and the government and the public prosecutor and the judicial authorities that were involved in the case kind of retracted, and the students, I think the students were released, and I think in almost all cases the charges were dropped, but not in every case. And so there's still this ongoing conflict between the students and the university authorities and the government. But if you look at the profile of Honduras in the media, take the British progressive house journal, The Guardian. They'll focus on Berta Cáceres, and they'll focus on another environmental battle going on in the far northwest of Honduras over a gold mine the company concerned. I've forgotten their name now, and they want to move an indigenous people's cemetery so that they can carry out their mining.
Right, the kind of thing that the Guardian and the Nation and some of the others like to focus on to show their progressive creds, and a worthy battle, but not the heart of what's going on in Honduras.
Well, right. And so they'll focus on the bad, the nasty, bad multinational corporations, and that's an okay thing, right? But you can't, they will not attack Juan Orlando Hernandez as a dictator.
Right, who was installed basically in the conditions following a coup that we've learned factually that Hillary Clinton had a big hand in. And what was cute at the DNC was they had people there that were there over Bertha's case, and it was being showcased at the DNC and essentially like something for Clinton to wear around her neck without having to carry the albatross that, oh, by the way, she was killed by the people that you put in power.
Yeah, she's responsible for consolidating the very model that led to Bertha's death.
That's right.
And also, by the way, and on August the 27th, it's the second anniversary of Margarita Maria's murder.
Right. Okay.
So and that's, you know, and but that the general repressive context that is very much a policy. It's a very concrete, conscious policy decision by Juan Orlando Hernandez and he's just a puppet, of course.
Washington.
For the elite interests, both in the region and in North America, that want that are determined to keep Honduras very much under their thumb. But that as you said, it's precisely that reality that's hidden. Whereas the reality in Honduras of this genuine democratization of the economy, democratization of cultural and social life in Nicaragua in a very inclusive way, and that is treated as a dictatorship.
Yep.
Yeah, in the most absurd. You know, if anybody who's familiar with Nicaraguan politics and society and the economy, and it's just so absurd. And it's like they're writing about a different country,
mm-hmm.
you know. So and that's and in Honduras, it's difficult to see how things are going to progress in Honduras, because at the moment there's a campaign going on by Juan Orlando Hernandez. It's really quite paradoxical. He's pushing for re-election, which is the very pretext, the spurious pretext for the coup in 2009.
Right.
And now Juan Orlando Hernandez is pushing for re-election so as to entrench and consolidate even more his totally a reactionary policy agenda. And you're in the paradoxical situation of having Manuel Zelaya, the president who was ousted from power, allegedly because he wanted to promote re-election.
Right.
Although he himself, back in 2009, it was impossible. There was no way he was going to stand for re-election because, but that's water under the bridge. But he's now campaigning against the re-election of the process that would constitutionally include re-election as a legitimate part of Honduras's constitution.
Right.
It'll be interesting to see how all that pans out in Honduras. But it's very difficult to see Manuel Zelaya or Libre breaking through they got about 30% of the vote in the elections in 2013, assuming, you know, rigged as they were, right? So that electoral system isn't going to change under the current political configuration in Honduras. So that is the system that Manuel Zelaya has to confront and deal with and involve himself and his party in order to make an electoral breakthrough. But it's almost impossible to see, despite the absolutely dire situation of them for the majority of people in Honduras. It's very difficult to see a political breakthrough because Honduras is kind of so fragmented. And Manuel Zelaya himself is unlikely to be able to mobilize sufficient support to break through the 30% ceiling that they reached in 2013.
Yeah, I know.
Actually, sorry, Don. One of the interesting things about Honduras, I know a little bit about the lives of ordinary rural people in Honduras because my partner is from Honduras originally, though she's a naturalized Nicaraguan citizen now. And her family live in the southern part of Honduras. And it's actually quite interesting to see how, with relatively small and very cost-effective measures, the Juan Orlando Hernandez's government and the political cronies that are not just from his own national party but also from the Liberal Party. In fact, it's worth pointing out that Juan Orlando Hernandez himself, his main political patron, is a former Liberal Party president, Carlos Flores Facuse. And that's just the political reality in Honduras of the way the elites, that in many ways it's very similar to the situation in the United States, where you have a kind of a plutocracy that presents itself through two parties, but they're actually representing almost identical interests. And the same thing happens in Honduras with the Liberal and National Party. So there's this kind of crossover between at the elite level, between the personalities that figure in one party or another. But it's interesting the way that they've devised this system of patronage, whereby, you know, in Honduras even now there's still land that's called ejido land. It's kind of common land that not belongs to the municipality. It's not owned by private individuals. Mm. And so what they'll do from time to time is they'll organize a housing program, not a housing program, but a land titling program. So they'll offer impoverished Hondurans plots of land a dramatic change in the economic circumstances of the people who might benefit from that offer.
Right.
And so so they use that kind of political patronage to in both rural and in urban areas to offer an option to people whom otherwise economically they are deliberately setting out to crush.
Right. And what it does, I mean, it's essentially it pits a small group of workers against the public property, basically. And there are people that are in desperate circumstances who see survival there.
Right. As well as survival, moderate incremental increase in their economic status.
Yeah. And
they may be getting paid peanuts in whatever day job that they get.
Right.
But at least they've got a plot of land.
That's right. That's right.
Oh, and the government gave it to me. Isn't that great?
That's a great. I'm voting for them again next time. But we got to stop there because we are out of time.
All right.
But we'll pick up here next week and whatever happens over the course of the week, including in Brazil around the games. And look forward to that.
Oh, yeah. We didn't talk about that, did we?
That's okay. We got time. Okay, Tony.
Okay,
thanks a lot.
Thanks a million, Tom.
Thank you. You've been listening to CPR Sunday. I'm Don DeBar, your host, and look forward to seeing you again next week.